DPU Podcast. Dentistry und Medicine innovativ denken. Herzlich willkommen. Mein Name ist Nick Pichler und als Host des DPU Podcasts spreche ich mit renommiertesten Expertinnen und Experten zum Thema Gesundheit für Körper, Geist und Seele. Auch heute geht es wieder um zwei sehr spannende Themen, und zwar um ein Thema, das manchmal vielleicht ein bisschen hinten ankommt und das es gar nicht verdient, und zwar um das Behavior Management in der Kinderzahnheilkunde. Ich meine, der Grundstein für einen gesunden Zahn, für gesunde Zähne wird in der Kindheit gelegt. Und da braucht es natürlich auch ganz besondere Ausbildungen und Verhaltensweisen gegenüber Kindern, dass das erfolgreich sein kann. Und von dem ausgehend werden wir dann noch ein ganz spannendes Thema weiterentdecken, und zwar Autismus. Denn ich habe ja heute eine der Spezialistinnen zu diesem Thema bei mir, direkt aus London, Wendy Ballis. Sie ist Spezialistin für den Bereich Behavior Management, Pediatric, und ist auch eine der absolut führenden Wissenschaftlerinnen im Bereich Autismus. Aufgrund ihrer Herkunft werden wir dieses Interview nun auf Englisch führen. Wendy, it's a great pleasure having you here with us. Thanks for joining me here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Wendy, a couple of minutes ago, you stopped your workshop with the students of the Danube Private University about behavior management. And after our last online meeting, our pre-interview to this podcast, I was thinking a little bit and I remembered something. I would like to share this with you right now. You know, when I was a child, I grew up pretty close to this place here in the village. And close to our place, there was only one dentist. And I refused to see him. As a five-year-old child, I refused to see him. I wasn't a very rebellious child, but I was very determined in this decision. So my parents had to go with me to Vienna, which is 100 kilometers away. And 45 years ago, this was pretty far. And to see a woman there, I remember her name till today, was Mrs. Rundschak, Dr. Rundschak. And I stayed with her till she retired. What do you think was her secret? What did me take to a journey of 100 kilometers to Vienna?
Well, I think you probably felt safe with her. And she engendered a feeling of confidence and safety, which is what children really want, because a child who doesn't feel safe usually feels anxious. So I think she probably communicated well with you. She understood that you were frightened, you were anxious. She may have acknowledged that in some way. And she adapted her communication style and addressed your worries. You were quite young at the time, so you probably weren't conscious of it. But she obviously had the right skills, and she was sympathetic, empathic as well to you. And the fact that you stayed with her until she retired, I think, is a tribute to her, whoever she is.
Yeah, it's a real tribute. Actually, my whole family went then to her.
Because oh, brilliant. She was That's good. Even better.
I don't remember the reasons that you just gave me, but you are doing workshops all over the world, yes, about this kind of topic. What do you think are the most important things for dentists to know about this?
With children, I think they need to communicate, and they need to do good dentistry for the child. They need to communicate with the child. They need to observe the child's behavior. They just need to listen to the child, I think, is important. Increasingly, we are talking with our patients rather than at our patients, which is something that's a really good idea. And asking them about if they're in pain or things are uncomfortable. I think we need to talk to our patients more, dentists and our child patients, and listen to them carefully and be sensitive to their needs.
But it's not just for children, actually, what you say.
No, this indeed.
It should be with patients.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And a lot of adults who are frightened of dentists, they put it down to a childhood experience, which I think is quite interesting. So I think as pediatric dentists, we have a responsibility to help children not develop anxiety and fear about dentistry, and to give them a positive experience as much as possible. At the same time, if they do need dental treatment, doing it in a supportive and pain-free way. so that they feel confident and safe.
You have a very long experience in that kind of field.
That makes me sound very old.
No, let's say an intense experience in that field. No, but
indeed.
What are your best learnings out of this experience?
Oh, I think just what I was saying, and listening to children and using techniques that are shown to work with children. So,
what kind of techniques?
Being empathic. Mm-hmm. So if a child looks frightened, actually say to them, "You look frightened today. This is all I'm going to do. Is that okay?" So acknowledging their fear is really important. And telling them when they're doing things well, telling them when they're doing things that are unhelpful, being specific with directions, is really important. Because most children want to try and help. If they can, and they want to please people, most children. There are exceptions. But yes, and being clear with children. But empathy is an underestimated, underused skill. So asking a child, "Is that okay? Mm-hmm. How are you feeling? Is that feeling better?" Just simple things like that can make a difference, rather than reassurance, which doesn't really work very well. Or telling a child that they're clever. Mm-hmm. It's important because self-esteem is also linked to anxiety. So if a child has low self-esteem, they tend to be quite anxious as well. So it's a very powerful thing to say to a child that they're clever. Not they're good, but they're clever. Mm-hmm. Some children, that's the only time they hear it.
So overall, it's all about communication and the skills for communication.
I think that's part of it. There are other things that you can do around it. So, you know, choosing the right, maximizing your environment, I suppose, and making sure your environment feels safe and comfortable.
How do you do that?
A child-friendly environment is helpful. So it's all the things that you probably know about furniture that's child-sized, you know, toys and music, things that make the parent and the child feel that they've come to the right place and they're welcome. Mm-hmm. And other things as well, like changing facilities for babies and things like that, mm-hmm. which makes the parent feel that this is a place where they want to bring their children, mm-hmm. basically.
So we have the pillar of the setting itself, then the pillar of communication. Is there
Indeed.
Something else?
Oh yes, and well, linked to communication, it's finding out about the child. So it's not direct communication, as but indirect communication. So providing the parents with information before they come, so that they've appropriately prepared the child for the visit. That's mm-hmm. important, so that they don't inadvertently prepare them in the wrong way. Mm-hmm. And finding out about past dental experiences and how you can learn from that. And generally, you know, things like what does the child like to be called? What toys do they like? What programs? So that you can establish some sort of a rapport with the child, because the rapport, the relationship mm-hmm. is important. I mean, it's one of the things that differentiates pediatric dentistry from adult dentistry. Is that you, with a child, you have to have a good relationship mm-hmm. with them, because otherwise they cry and they get out of the chair. Whereas adults, if they don't like you, they will just put up with it usually mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And not pay their bills maybe afterwards. but with children, they are very upfront, and if they don't like you, they will show you. And so, and you can't do the work, you can't do the dentistry that they need, whereas with adults, they put up with more. So you have to be much more fine-tuned with children, and you have to observe the effect that your language is having on them and their reaction to it. You have to be open to it.
So that means the work actually starts before the visit.
Oh, indeed. Yes, I think so.
And how can I imagine that? You know, someone makes an appointment. Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. So there has to be an interview mm-hmm. when making this appointment?
No, not necessarily. It can be done remotely. I mean, the first thing is that we all wish as dentists, pediatric dentists certainly, that we see children from as early an age as possible. Ideally before they're a year old, mm-hmm. because then you can start with preventive messages and making sure the parents are doing all the right things for the child, and also getting the child used to the environment. I mean, that would be the gold standard, seeing a child as young as possible so that they don't actually need any dental treatment. They've had the right advice and they've been able to follow it. So that would be, that's the gold standard, I suppose. And if a new patient comes to you, then sending out or either by email or by post a pre-appointment questionnaire and information about the practice. So for addressing perhaps unrealistic expectations. So parents sometimes expect when they bring a child to see you that you're going to do two fillings at the first visit or something. But in fact, what you need to do as a good pediatric dentist is to find out about the child, give them advice on preventive measures, take radiographs, do all the things like that that need doing, and coming up with some sort of plan of treatment. But some parents, they don't understand that because it's not been their experience. So you have an opportunity in some sort of pre-appointment letter to outline that and say, you know, we might not do any treatment the first visit. We spend some time getting to know your child and making sure they go on to, you know, have good teeth in, as they grow up. We may do some treatment, but not necessarily. And you might want to put some sort of link in there to some audiovisual thing online, introducing children to dentistry, you know, the cartoon character or something, so that they're prepared appropriately. And there's some evidence to show that if you send these questionnaires to certainly to the mother, that it reduces the mother's anxiety as well.
Is this transferred directly to the child?
It can be, yes. Maternal anxiety and young children and some older children, but the mothers inadvertently and accidentally transfer their anxieties sometimes to their young children, which can be a problem, particularly if they're very, very scared. It's very hard for mothers to hide it, and children are very perceptive to their mothers, of course, so they pick it up.
From your point of view, this sounds perfect. Yeah, when you talk about this, sounds perfect. But how many dentists are doing that?
I don't think many. It depends, and it's which always surprises me, because for me, you're getting information, and information is knowledge and power. And so, when the child comes to see you, you feel as if you already know them. You've got some information on them. Which I think can only be a good thing, particularly if it's about, you know, what they like to be called, or whether they have any siblings or a pet dog or something like that. Again, it's about establishing some sort of relationship with the child.
I would like to explore another field now with you, where you're of one of the specialists, and this is also about special needs. You work and a lot in the field of autism. It's also coming from your work experience.
Indeed.
And I did some research. In Austria, 87,000 people are affected by autism. In Germany, it's 800,000 people. So it's around more or less 1% of the population.
Yes, indeed.
I don't know how the numbers
in the UK,
Great Britain.
Yes, it's 1% is the ballpark figure that most of us have. It does vary in different countries, but it's very difficult to measure how many people have autism.
But I was quite surprised, and I'm not quite sure if this is the real figure, because after our pre-interview, I was thinking about also different people in my surrounding, and I thought, as we were talking, I'm not quite sure if this is not also some autistic behavior. And my first question is a tough one, but is autism a disease?
No, it's not a disease. It's a condition. It used to be called a disorder, but it is a condition, because what the word suggests is that it's a situation that, and it can vary from quite profound manifestations and impact on someone's life to quite minor ones, but they would still have the basic problems associated with autism around social integration and communication and sensory issues, which even patients, even people, I should say, with so-called mild autism, they often have symptoms, I suppose, and that are not obvious because they mask and they cover them up. And so they don't necessarily show themselves as being autistic, or they, unless you know them very well, because many adults, particularly women, have got used to masking and covering up their symptoms associated with autism just to fit in and just to be able to function in society, which is sad.
Is this the reason why actually in the research shows that there are more boys affected by autism than girls in the ratio of 4 to 1?
That's the figure that is usually quoted. But yeah. I think if you do this in a few years' time, you'll find that it's more like 3 to 1 or even less. Okay. Because what we do know is that there's a huge underdiagnosis of autism amongst girls and young women. For the reasons I've just said, and that masking is part of it, very good at covering up their behaviour, and also adopting behaviours to fit in with their peers. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't cancel out the underlying autism that's there. They still often feel very anxious, and that can manifest in other ways. Eating disorders, for instance, are quite common. In women and young girls with autism.
At what age does autism show?
Well, if you know what you're looking for, very, very early on.
Yeah?
Yes, so the average age of diagnosis varies in different countries. And also, there are long waiting lists for a diagnosis. So it's difficult to come up with a figure, but I know that the figure is coming down. It used to be 4, but it's coming down to 3 and 2. Years of age. It really depends, though, because if there's a family history of autism, people know what they're looking for, so it often gets diagnosed earlier because it is predominantly a genetic condition.
Genetic, okay. It's completely genetic, or are there also some other
influences? It's mostly genetic, and but there are environmental features as well, and they're not quite sure what they are, and various papers are being published about it, but they think that people have may have the tendency but don't show it until there's some sort of environmental trigger.
When we talk about show it, you also mentioned profound and mild before. Could you describe how does profound autism shows and how does mild autism shows, for example?
Profound would probably be a child that's nonverbal, so unable to speak, severe sensory issues, so sensory problems, and severe anxiety. Those would be the main features. So being nonverbal and having a learning disability, an intellectual disability. So if you measured their IQ, for instance, it would be quite low. At the other end of the spectrum might be someone who is in the media, who is a little bit odd, maybe. I'm sure we can all think of people like that. And it's only if you know them well, you can see these tendencies to having sensory issues, perhaps poor eye contact, a lack of, or a restriction of, not a lack, but a restriction in empathy, or the way they show empathy to other people. Perhaps selective diets. Okay. That's how someone, they used to be called high-functioning autism. That's how often they manifest.
So it could be that we think someone is rude, for example, is not
indeed,
rude at all.
Indeed. There used to be a theory about saying that autistic people lack empathy, but that's not accepted anymore, and that was found to be not right. It's just that they experience empathy, but they just find it difficult to show it.
They experience it, but they cannot
indeed,
show it.
But they don't necessarily show it in conventional ways. There's also something called hyperempathy as well, which some autistic people just find that they empathize too much with other people, and they find it quite crippling. which is a fairly recently acknowledged phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. So when the diagnosis doesn't happen in early age and the people grow with this, they, I suppose they think something is not right with me, but I have to be in a group, to fit into a group, I have to do something against that, what mm-hmm. happens mm-hmm. in me. What I mean is, how do people feel when they are not getting diagnosed? Do you have
I think any? It must be, if they haven't, they don't know that they've got it, then I think it must, if they don't know that they're in the spectrum, then I think it must be very confusing for them,
mm-hmm.
Because they don't understand why they feel and behave in the way that they do.
Mm-hmm.
This is, it's much easier now with mm-hmm. much more coverage in the media of autism. So more and more adults and older people are getting the diagnosis of autism now, which previously wasn't there before. But going back to your previous point about girls and the 4-to-1 ratio, one of the problems is the diagnostic criteria that have changed over the years. So it's one of the reasons why we seem to be seeing more autism is because it's becoming more inclusive. We're including more mm-hmm. conditions in it. So I think if we did this study, if we looked at the gender difference in a few years' time, might find it more equal amongst mm-hmm. boys and girls. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
You told me in our pre-interview about a lady, she was 72?
Yes, and she'd spent her whole life with anxiety issues, unable to sustain friendships and social relationships. I think she had eating disorders as well. And eventually she went somewhere in London and she was given a diagnosis of autism, and it must have been a huge relief for her
mm-hmm.
because she just felt as if she was, most of her life had felt outside of society. It must have been such a relief, but sadly late.
mm-hmm. And when we talk about autism, we think about that it's the general opinion, it's kind of a weakness. Yeah, you say it's a condition. And it absolutely is a condition, but is there not also a lot of strength in this condition?
Oh yes. I mean, I think that we are encouraged to embrace neurodiversity in all its forms these days,
mm-hmm.
and certainly knowing people or coming across people who are in the spectrum, they can be fascinating,
mm-hmm.
And I've learned a lot about human behavior, I think, by observing it and engaging to a certain extent with people. Although my clinical work was predominantly with children who were at the less able end of the spectrum. The more able end used to be called Asperger's, which doesn't technically exist anymore. That if people have been given the diagnosis, they retain it, but it's not a new, it's not a diagnosis that is given anymore because of the change in the diagnostic criteria. And certainly I had a few patients with Asperger's, and they were just very interesting when I saw them, and it made me look at the world slightly differently, which I think is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
As a dentist, you tend to see things in black and white, but I now appreciate the grey, I think.
Mm-hmm. And are there special professions where autistic people really have profound careers?
Yes, one of the features of autism is concentrating on tasks to a minute degree sometimes, and so they work well in environments where attention to detail is necessary, something that autistic people are very good at. So they flourish in those, being librarians and things that need to be in a certain way, not necessarily interacting with the public at the same time, but yes, I think they should certainly have a great deal to contribute to certain aspects of the workforce. And there are some companies that have a neurodiverse positive employment strategy. So they actively go and seek people out who are in the spectrum because they know that they are very committed. Attention to detail is fantastic, very ordered, and so they function really well in those environments and in those posts.
So there's also a place for them in the dental industry. So there's also place for them in the dental industry.
I'm not sure about that. Yes, I'm sure. I mean, I have met autistic dentists, mm-hmm. for sure, which has been quite interesting over the years, increasingly so. I speak in various places, and it's now not uncommon for someone in the audience to come up to me and say that they've recently had a diagnosis of autism. And usually they've had it, the diagnosis, because their child has had a diagnosis and they have backtracked through the family. And so it continues to surprise me. Dentistry is a very stressful profession. So I think the people who are in the spectrum and dentists, I think they must have ways of dealing with the anxiety and the stress, which I don't know how they do it, really.
How do you treat autism? Can you heal autism?
No.
But how do you treat the condition?
I think some people would question the term "treat it." Mm. If a child is given a diagnosis of autism, they're usually channeled towards early behavioural interventions. So linking behaviours with rewards or tailoring jobs and tasks to the child's strengths. So medication and special diets are not the first line of treatment or addressing autism. It's behavioural interventions, and the earlier you expose the child to those, the better. It has better outcomes if the parent and the child are able to engage in these interventions from an early age.
What I think about is very important are the people who deal with autistic people. Mm-hmm. But how do you deal correctly? How do you behave correctly? What can one do?
Well, I think you have to ask yourself certain questions. I mean, what makes a person a professional good at working with people with autism? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Well, I think the questions you have to ask yourself are, number one, what sort of a person are you? If something goes wrong, are you the sort of person that is defensive and worried, or are you the sort of person that says, I wonder why that happened? Mm-hmm. I want to find out. So I think you've got to be curious. You have to be able to accept new ways of communicating, and that's not easy always. So visual ones and storyboards and things like that. You have to have the time as well, because children and the people in the spectrum tend to take extra time. So you've got to acknowledge that. You've got to be able to think outside the box too, to a certain extent. And by appreciating some of the barriers and some of the problems that they come across in their lives, that sometimes helps you think outside the box and think flexibly. And you've got to be able to, can you adapt your own personal approach and perhaps your environment to accommodate people who are in the spectrum who might have sensory issues? Those are questions that you need to ask yourself. And also, I suppose, are you the sort of person that can cope with, sometimes it's two steps forward, one step back. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's two steps back, one step forward. Are you the sort of personality that can cope with that, or as a sort of just as a person? Some people like to move forward all the time. And I suppose the last one would be, are you comfortable with behaviour that is a bit unusual? And you can define unusual in all sorts of ways. And if you're happy with, if the answer is a yes to all those, then you're probably the right sort of person to be able to manage people who are in the spectrum.
This brings me on a personal note to my next question. Mm-hmm. Why did you dive deep into this field? Why is autism so
Because so I didn't understand it. I don't like mysteries. I don't like not understanding things. And I was seeing patients, children referred to me with autism in the late 90s, and there wasn't an awful lot of literature about it. I consumed what there was to learn because I think knowledge is power to a certain extent and strength. And it just fascinated me. And I realized that also I spoke to a lot of parents and asked them what the problems were that they were experiencing or had experienced in the past and tried to learn from that. And I listened to parents. I asked parents. And they've been my greatest teachers, I think, because they are the experts on their children. I'm the dental expert, but they're the expert on their child, and without them you can't do anything. So I'm still in contact with many of my my ex-patients who are now grown up and in their late 20s. And yes, it was a very valuable experience. And as I said, I realised that there was very little written about autism. I did write some chapters in books and a few papers here and there, but I'm very much a doer rather than a writer. Mm-hmm. So I'm much more qualitative than quantitative, I think. So I learnt a lot from there. And as I said, there were a lot of things that weren't understood at the time and are still not understood. But knowing that no one understood them was really important to me as well. Mm-hmm. And looking at websites and just trying to find out as much information as possible. I suppose I'm just curious.
Stay curious. Mm-hmm. On that note, I thank you very much for being with me here in this podcast interview. Thanks a lot for the insights that you gave us. It was very interesting. And
thank you very much. You're very welcome.
Ihnen, liebe Zuhörerinnen und Zuhörer, danke ich fürs Dabeisein und freue mich, Sie auch beim nächsten DPU-Podcast wieder begrüßen zu dürfen.